You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin. For all of Wisconsin. Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Civic Media Spotlight. We begin with Daybreak with Brian and Jamie. Brian and Jamie are joined by Bill Luters, the president of Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. He shares information about the loophole recently brought to light that allows lawmakers to delete records that should be publicly accessible through open record requests.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Civic Media Network. A beautiful start to your Thursday if you're listening in Richland Center on WRCE or in La Crosse on WLCX or even in Wisconsin Rapids on WFHR. Thank you so much for being here today. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And good morning, I'm Brian Noonan. If you are a public employee in Wisconsin, you're required to maintain records to comply with the state's open records law. This might surprise you, though. There is a group that is exempt from that law, and it, ironically, is the people who write the laws. A loophole in the law allows Wisconsin lawmakers to delete public records. If that sounds a little fishy to you, well, join the club. So how did this law come into existence? Should we be concerned about how it's been used? And does the new bill brought forth by Democrats have a chance of passing? Bill Luters, president at Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, joins us to answer those questions. Bill, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time. To help everybody fully understand this loophole, can you first explain the open records law and the history of this particular exemption?
Sure. Back in early 1980s, the state updated and passed the current version of the public records or open records law. Basically, our law says that any document in the possession of any state or local public agency or official is presumptively open, that it's presumed that you can ask for it and receive it. But you only can release and receive release information that you have. And there's a separate statute that deals with records retention rules. And that statute exempts members of the legislature and their staffs from the record retention rules that are in place for everybody else. So if you are the street superintendent of Oshkosh and you get a letter about a cracked sidewalk, you are obligated to hold on to that record for a statutory period of time, generally 7 years. But if you're a lawmaker and you get an email from a lobbyist saying, you know, you vote this way and I'll get some money to your campaign, you can say, boy, that would look bad if that came out, and you can delete it.
Wow.
Now, I don't know that it's been used for that, but what it has been used for over the years, particularly in the last decade after it became better known that this exemption existed, is that lawmakers delete correspondence that weighs in on legislation they propose. So I'll give you an example. Is about a decade ago, Wisconsin ended its Government Accountability Board, broke it up from being a nonpartisan agency to being two bipartisan agencies that were staffed with political appointees. And at the time, some citizens made records requests for the feedback that the lawmakers who proposed this change were receiving. And it turned out like 95% of the people who wrote them, and there was quite a few people who wrote them about this, said that was a bad idea. We don't want that. Please don't do this. But they did it anyway. So you can see a situation like that. It would save them some embarrassment if when you ask for records, they don't have to turn over records that show that they ignored the overwhelming amount of input they received. They can just say, oh, we didn't keep that record. We're not required to keep it.
So, Bill, what does this actually mean for, you know, say, regular people, the constituents of our lawmakers who are trying to understand what their elected officials are doing? Does this get into transparency and trust for a lot of people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a law that could lead and probably already has led to abuse, if not actual corruption, because you can erase all record of the records that that you receive that other government officials would have to provide on request. You can destroy at will. Now, there is a feature of our open records law that once a person requests a record, you can't destroy it. I mean, once there's a pending records request, mm-hmm. even though you might have been able to destroy it beforehand, you can't destroy it anymore. So that's a nice feature of our law, that when somebody makes a request, if you haven't already thought about getting rid of it, you can't do it now.
Bill, have there been attempts in the past to close this loophole?
Yes, legislative attempts. Senator Chris Larson, a Democrat from Milwaukee, has introduced legislation to end this exemption session after session. There's a new bill that was just introduced by Representative Clinton Anderson, a Democrat from Beloit, which would accomplish the same thing. And Senator Larson is aligned with Representative Anderson on the reintroduction of this bill.
We're talking with Bill Leaders this morning. He is the president at Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, NFOIC.org, if you want to check them out and get more information. Do most people realize...
It's WF.
WF. I'm sorry. Thank you for that correction.
You can just Google Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council.
Perfect. Do most people, Bill, realize that this loophole exists, or is this something that's sort of flying under the radar?
Well, there was a story this week. This is Sunshine Week, a national observance of transparency and open government. And a lot of media outlets take this opportunity to write a story about some feature or problem with our transparency laws. And Peter Cameron of the Badger Project wrote a piece that ran under Wisconsin Watch about this particular exemption, just, you know, raised it as an issue. So more people know about it now, presumably, because of that story. Overall, I don't think it's very well known that this exemption exists. When we first became aware of it a little bit more than a decade ago, we tried not to call any attention to it for a while because we knew that most lawmakers didn't realize that they had this ability.
Sure.
And we didn't want to give them any ideas. But sooner or later, it became clear that they had caught into it already. And so we could actively criticize the fact that they had this freedom to destroy records.
Is this type of loophole, Bill, unique to Wisconsin? Is it just a state thing? Does it exist on the federal level? Are we seeing this everywhere?
No, I think there are other states that do restrict access to lawmakers' records. In fact, there's 12 states overall that won't allow any access. They completely exempt the legislature from all records laws, not just correspondence, but everything. In fact, Congress does that too. Congress, the U.S. Senate, they are not required to provide access to the correspondence that they send and receive. They're categorically exempt from the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And, you know, as I said, there's some states have exemptions for all records. Some states have exemptions for what's called deliberative process records. By that, it means whatever goes into the deliberations and the creation of legislation, the back and forth, mm-hmm. should we say this, should we say this, should we include this, should we not include this, would be exempt from disclosure in certain states. In 2015, the Wisconsin legislature tried to pass an exemption for deliberative process materials for itself and some other government entities. And there was a big backlash at the time, they had to withdraw that proposal. It died in the light of overwhelming public scorn.
As I'm sitting here thinking about this, and I'm thinking about your career as a journalist and all the journalists who are trying to do their jobs throughout the state, how is this actually affecting them trying to do their jobs and hold lawmakers accountable and get the actual story sometimes of what's happening?
Well, I think you can get to something substantive in saying that the lawmaker said that he did not retain any records regarding this issue. You know, to point out that a lawmaker may have exercised this authority to destroy records is probably more damning than anything the records contain. So I think reporters should ask for records, and if they're not provided and you have reason to believe that they exist and they were not provided because they were destroyed, to make public issue of that. That's not a best practice approach to governance.
Bill Leaders is our guest. He's president at Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. WFOIC.org is their website. Bill, it sounds like if you're going into politics for the right reason, this shouldn't be an issue. But we've talked about the attempts before and the current bill that is coming to the Senate floor. Who is opposing this on the state level? Is it just straight partisan? Is it, and what reasons are they giving for pushing back against this, this change?
You're going to hate this, but I don't know. I'm not aware specifically of who is registered for or against this newly introduced legislation. It's probably something that isn't going to get a lot of public position staking, that it will just not come up for a vote. It's very unlikely that this will pass previous incarnations of a bill to end the lawmakers' exemption from the retention laws. Have failed. They've not even had hearings. So I don't think it's going anywhere, and I don't think anyone's going to make a big fuss and beat their chest and say, this is why we don't want it to go anywhere. They're just going to let it quietly die.
Wow.
That's
so what can we do?
Yeah.
Well, like I say, journalists should continue to make requests for records. Here's something that we thought, and in fact, we did a column on this, a Your Right to Know column, which on our website is, you can request a lawmaker's deleted emails. I mean, they don't go away when you hit delete. They go into a queue where they're retrievable. You as a reporter or a citizen can make a records request for the emails they deleted, and you can see what they're getting rid of. So that's a way to short circuit their ability. Another thing you could do, although I don't know that anyone has done this, is to make a daily request for all of the emails that they receive and send. Because once you make that request, they can't destroy it anymore. So every morning at 8 o'clock, you're automatically sending out a records request to the head of the Joint Finance Committee or whatnot for all of the record, all of the emails sent and received that day.
How is this connecting to some of the bigger concerns about things like about influence? You know, you think of lobbyists, you think about the special interests, and going back to the public's right to know.
Yeah, well, one of the ways that I have used records requests with regard to legislation is to get the temperature of response. Like, there's a bill that tightened drunk driving laws, and I went and I saw the enormous amount of public response to that proposal, most in favor of tightening our laws. And people told heartbreaking stories of how drunk drivers had killed people that they knew and loved and wounded people they knew and loved. It added a dimension to the story. To see the real people respond to a legislative proposal that was going to change the terrain in terms of how drunk driving is treated.
Bill, we've got about a minute and a half left. In your experience, are most legislators pretty responsive to a records request, or most offices, or how long does it usually take for a journalist to get things, or the public to get things that they've requested?
It depends. I mean, a voluminous request may take a while. A simple request may be answered very, very soon. I think, by and large, most public officials in Wisconsin, and even most legislators, are mindful of their responsibility to provide records on request. There are records that they still do provide on a routine basis. There's nothing that stops them from providing all of the records that people request. There's nothing that requires them to delete records that they don't want seen. Yeah, by and large, I think there's a good deal of support among lawmakers and other public officials for the idea of transparency. It's one of the tools they have to build trust with the people that they represent.
Are there, I know, very, very quickly, can you, I guess, never mind. Parker's giving me the wrap-up music. I was going to talk about some other exemptions, but Parker's keeping me on task here. We're going to have to bring you back at some point to talk about some of the other things that legislatures can do in these exemptions. Bill Leaders is our guest this morning. He is the president at Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Thank you so much for joining us today, Bill. Very informative stuff. It is 8:19 right now. You are listening to Daybreak. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan, and this is the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
We stay right here on the Civic Media Spotlight with Daybreak with Brian and Jamie. And a reminder to read beyond the headlines We look at the story that Governor Tony Evers vetoed in a child care bill that on the surface level looked good. As Brian and Jamie dive into the story, they learn why Evers vetoed the bill and even agrees with his decision.
6:22 right now. We hope that your morning is going well so far. Thank you so much for joining us. Hey, Brian, don't forget that we've got another chance for everybody to qualify for some really great cash and prizes. Ooh. Coming up in less than an hour with our multi-state text-to-win contest. This is the portion of the morning where we remind you to get your Civic Media app downloaded in case you don't already have it, because that's the only way that you can qualify for a daily prize of $200 or that grand prize, which is that Verlo Queen mattress set over $1,300 value. So not bad.
Right. You get the sheets, you get the mattress pad, you get some pillows, you get the whole deal. And we've already given away 2 days worth of cash. Mm-hmm. So strap in. We're doing this for 2 weeks. So should be fun. And then the grand prize winner will be announced.
Plenty of chances to qualify throughout each and every day. And the beauty of it is you can enter every single time you want throughout the day using your Civic Media.
Oh, is that right?
We have no limits on how many times you can enter. So I noticed yesterday there were a couple people who actually entered the same hour twice or three times.
I noticed that too, and I wondered if that was legit.
That's totally legit.
It's like a Chicago election. Vote early, vote often. Come on in, and we'll, you know,
absolutely.
Good luck.
Absolutely.
Good luck to you. If you're just sitting around all day and you have access to your phone and your app, just listen for, because the word changes throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And listen for the new word, enter up, and there you go.
I love it.
So this is another, please, we must always read past the headlines. If you take nothing away from this show, it's read past the headline. The headline, Governor Evers vetoes a bill that would extend tax credits for child care, for businesses dealing with child care. And you're like, ooh, why would he do something that evil? And then you go, oh, wait a minute. I'm going to read the second paragraph.
Damn that Tony Evers. Yeah, it turns out you got to read a little bit.
Well, I got to side with the governor on this, because forever we've always talked about pork being jammed into all these bills, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, there's always something that tries to get snuck in. And so the governor looked at this bill. It was a catch-all rule that would allow businesses to claim tax credits for just about any expense tied to childcare. And the governor said, hold on, that seems a little broad to me, and it could lead to a lot of fraud and abuse, which we know never happens with government funding. Everybody's above board, straight up. So we vetoed it.
Just go talk to Tim Walz if you want to know how that works out in Minnesota.
Maybe Tony called Tim. Listen, what's going on? I know you're having a little trouble with that daycare stuff. What do you think of this one?
Right.
Ooh, no. And Walz is just like, no, save yourself the headache.
I always want to know how many of those conversations happen in private, honestly.
Yeah.
Right? Anyway, but I think this is an interesting case, though, because another issue with this particular bill is it didn't actually include any funding for the actual oversight either. So the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or WEDC, would be responsible for monitoring it without any extra resources. And the proposal came as the state is, as a lot of families know, already dealing with a child care crisis, right?
Yes.
There is rising costs for the families. Providers are struggling to stay open, trying to accommodate the rules, the regulations, all of the increases that they're going through. There's also limited access to really great facilities across the state. And the ones that do have, if you do happen to find a really great center, I know there's also a lot of people who end up on a really long waiting list because of problems with access. The governor had previously supported a more targeted change when it came to child care, allowing businesses to invest in third-party child care programs or even loan funds. He called that approach more strategic and responsible. The original tax credit, which goes back to 2023, covered 15% of child care facility investments, had no businesses actually take advantage of it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is kind of crazy, right? Child care providers criticize.
Yeah, but not really. I mean, we're talking about existing companies, right? Not people going into the child care business.
Right.
But if, say, Civic Media wanted to open a daycare center, just for Parker and the, you know, the other young technical producers, so they could have juice boxes and roll around.
Graham cracker breaks and stuff.
I would love some juice boxes.
And nap time, yes.
Oh, nap time.
And then we'd have to hire a comely young daycare worker to take care of the boys and swaddle them when they're crying.
Then we've invented something completely different in whatever is happening.
But either way, nobody's taking advantage of that. We can get 15% for the investment.
Right.
But nobody's taking them up on that, which I understand. It's a hassle because as a business, you're taking on not only the cost involved, but another liability.
Yep.
And I understand its benefits to the employees 100%.
Right.
Because then you can always squeeze a couple more minutes out of your employees because they don't have to leave because they know, pickup is only a couple steps away instead of across town and I've got to get, you know, the car. So
to have the space. You have to accommodate if it is a child care facility. There's lots of rules and regulations that you have to adhere to through the state.
Yes.
So I do
and
understand.
15% still leaves, let me do the
a
math,
big gap.
85% you have to pay yourself?
A big gap. Let's put it like that. But
big gap.
In this particular case, child care providers criticized this bill that the governor vetoed, saying it wouldn't solve any real issues like costs or staffing shortages. And, you know, if you're wondering how it even made it to the governor's desk with all of this pushback, it passed mostly along party lines. Republicans support it. Democrats opposed it, most of them anyway. And Evers says this bill really just tried to expand too much too quickly without any safeguards. So he wants a more focused, funded solution that actually addresses the child care crisis that we have in this particular state. I mean, no matter how you look at it, our entire system, and I think this, it doesn't just apply to Wisconsin, but I think a lot of states across the board need a completely revamped system of how we do child care, right?
Yes.
It's got to be better for families and it's got to be better for the child care providers. There has to be some win-win in there somewhere, right?
I want my child care providers to be able to live on their wage so they're a little happier coming to work instead of working for minimum wage.
Which is a whole different
doing
topic.
It for the love of the game. Whole different topic. We got to go. This is Daybreak. It's a Civic Media Network. There you go, Parker.
Next up on the Civic Media Spotlight, we have Lean Local with Jim Schmidt. Jim talks to Jim Ritterbusch. Jim currently serves on the city council, specifically District 8.
With your host, former Green Bay Mayor Jim Schmidt.
All right, welcome everyone to another episode of Lean Local. And this is the show where we do what we say in the title. We lean into the local community. And these last couple weeks and for the next couple weeks, we've really been focused on the local candidates here in Greater Green Bay. As I've told you many times, you know, comes to a presidential election or governor's election, you know, there's lines. But people just, I don't know if people realize just how important the local government is. I mean, these are the people who are pick up the garbage, they take care of the parks, they fund the police department, the fire department. And when you look at your tax bill, it's real. And, you know, where's that money going? So that's why I thought we'd take it upon ourselves here at Lean Local to really lean into the candidates. Let's get to know them. They're working hard. I'm going to tell you, I did that for over 20 years, you know, knocking on doors, but not everybody's home, and send literature, and they use it for kindling. So we want to get them in here. And the thing is, you can say, well, you know, other media picks it up, but they don't have the time for this. And they don't have a half hour to sit down and just really talk to someone that you may or may not know. And as you know, we have the city council election coming up. This is all April 7th, as well as the county board. And that's as local as you can get. So that's why we want to bring these candidates in. And today, in studio, we have with us Jim Ritterbusch. And you may know that name. He serves on the city council presently, and this is District 8. That's what I thought. District 8. And we're going to talk a little bit about District 8, some of their issues, and then we're going to talk about the city issues as well. But before we do that, welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Yep, glad to be with you.
All right. And so tell me, like, did you have a bug for this, or why are you running?
Well,
Chris, you're on the council now. Maybe you want to explain to the listeners how you got on the council, first of all, because it's you've been on for...
I've actually ran this the fourth time I've run. I ran twice against Guy Zimma, I'm kind of a guy who really wanted to be on city council. I've taken on 40-year incumbents, 20-year incumbents, and I'm willing to put the work in. So I started to get involved in government through our neighborhood associations. I've been president of the Marquette Park Neighborhood Association for about 16 years. I've also been vice chair of Green Bay Neighborhoods for the last, I believe, 6 years. Yeah. So when you get involved with neighborhoods, you kind of know what our citizens want. I'm also on the board of directors for the United Way. So through that organization also, you learn to what the needs are of our citizens in Green Bay.
That's great. And so you ran unsuccessfully, and that's one of the reasons you talk about these 20-year people. We have term limits now, so you're there for 12 years. I happen to be a big advocate of that. But you can always come back and run again after you take a little bit of a break. So it's not like you can never run for politics again. But you had the opportunity. The alderman who was in office stepped aside, and then you applied. It was a different. It wasn't really an election as much
no,
as
it was. Three people applied, myself, Mark Anderson, and Megan Bouchard. And it was a ranked choice system. So basically all the aldermen, we gave our speeches, our sales pitch to the council, and they selected the person. The first person that got six ones was the one that got selected. And I was fortunate enough to be that person, and I've been serving since June. And I'm really liking it. I'm still learning a lot. I mean, you get phone calls, and you got to sort through what's, you know, reality, what you can do, what you can't do.
So let's talk about that, because you really didn't do a lot of campaigning in the public eye when you were appointed by the city council or voted in by the city council. But now you are, and there's a difference. And like, what are you hearing at the doors, or what are you hearing on the phone?
Well, like conversation we had before, it's nice when people answer their door, because you might knock 50 doors and you're lucky if you get six people that answer the door. But people know who I am because I've been very active in the community through all the different you know, neighborhood associations, United Way. So people know who I am. I'm on council. They recognize my name. I didn't get to campaign for this position, but I've campaigned three times before. So I feel I've put the work in.
I don't doubt that. What I was asking though was when you talk to people, are there things that you see a common thread on their concerns, or you?
The roads. Everybody wants to talk about roads. There's not enough money to fix the roads. Housing. Some people have issues with some of the parks in around their area, which I happen to be on the parks committee. So, you know, I can help facilitate some of those issues that they may have.
All right. And roads has a little bit to do with our weather, but there's other communities that are in the same climate that have better roads than us.
When you get rain and freeze, you're going to have bad roads. It's just the Wisconsin thing. But unfortunately, our state government has kind of taken away some of the money, the revenue to help fix that. Yeah. So that's where the shortfall.
And some people still complain to me, and of course they did but some of the roads aren't in the city. You know, everybody thinks because all the suburbs call themselves Green Bay, So there may be something in Alloway, like maybe Alloway Avenue, that's their roller coaster,
Shano Avenue is a state highway.
Right.
We're waiting for them to fix it, but they're not going to come until like 2032 or something.
So now
we're going to go through and resurface part of it to try to.
I think that's a really good idea.
Survive till they do redo everything.
Yeah. So if you look at the city right now from your view, what do you see as the top like two or three issues facing us over the next, let's say, 4 or 5 years?
Well, housing. I mean, we need to find housing. We want to build our population. We need places for people to live. Which would be multi-family and duplexes, houses. JBS is prime example of a housing project that I was actually part of. I was a kind of a facilitator as the labor rep for the workers at JBS. And it was kind of cool to be part of that. But we need more of those kind of things in our community.
So housing, there's people who want to live in Green Bay, but there's no housing. Is that what you're telling me?
It's just a shortage. Yeah. You run out of space. I mean, you run out of space just like Alloway is pretty much landlocked. There's really no parcels there to build.
Well, Alloway, that's only 4 square miles.
Yeah.
They're totally.
That's part of the reason why the Alloway wants to take over where the prison's at.
Yeah.
They want to build some housing and retail there.
And then they say, well, we can't grow up. We're going to grow up. But that's difficult too. I mean, these high rises, right, and do they really fit? And but Green Bay's got 50 square miles, and we do have some elbow room here.
Yeah, I mean, there's places to build, but we just actually passed the council to try to get rid of some of the red tape to build certain kind of houses.
That's good.
Because there were so many restrictions on what you can build and where you can build that we changed a couple of ordinances to help, you know, be able to build houses, different sizes and shapes and heights.
And then you did some things on zoning. I didn't follow as closely as I should have, but where you live, your district, the district you represent, has some packer houses, as they call them, and some rentals, and that's been going back and forth. And I think some people wanted some, well, you tell me, I mean, didn't some people want those to be non-rentals?
Yeah, there was a thing that went through the Equal Rights Commission. They felt that because of people buying houses for short-term rentals, that it's kind of ruining the stock of housing in Green Bay, which when we really sat down and looked at it, it's about 1% of the households in Green Bay that are short-term rentals. That was my first hot topic in office, and I learned a lot about it. I had people calling me from all over the country, you know, wanting me to support them, but I have to support them, but I also have to think of the residents who live there.
Oh yeah.
And I do think about that because they're the ones that are my, you know, my constituents. So it was kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, but I think we had, through city council, we had a really good dialogue on how to take care of that by putting an ordinance. There's always been ordinances, but unfortunately our city hasn't been following them. I mean, policing. The people who live next to these short-term rentals, they have to report things. If there's no report, it doesn't get documented and they don't get checked out. Now we have a mechanism where it's going to work a little bit better to have citizens report things and it gets documented. And if they're bad actors, they're going to lose their license.
Do you think that's, I mean, that is that a Band-Aid or is that, are we fixing it? Wasn't there a time, I don't say, I'm asking you, but I know the answer, where that was just going to be zoned more commercial, you know? Because I feel bad. I've got calls from the guy who's got two kids and doesn't want to live next to an empty house, but doesn't want to live next to a party house either. And he's going back and forth. And is this where I should be to raise my kids? And you got to be honest with these guys and say, I don't think so. You know, I think, you know, you want to play football in the backyard with the neighbors, that ain't going to happen where you live.
There's, in those areas, there's not a lot of kids going to school there because they're all rentals.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that is an issue. But unfortunately, the state is the one that mandates a lot of the laws on short-term rentals. So the city's kind of got their hands tied until they open the laws up where cities can take more control of it.
All right. So you talk about the roads and the housing. Those are like the two main issues that you see the future. Anything else that? I ask everybody the same question. I'm just curious, Jim.
Well, some people say crime. I myself don't think we're very bad. I think our crime has gone down drastically over the years. Like I say, I've lived here my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in the same house I live in right now. I lived in my house for 51 years.
Nice.
So I know the Marquette Park area like the back of my hand. And, you know, I had a neighbor lady talk about how bad the crime is in there. She's afraid to get out and walk at night. And I'm just like, I don't see that. You know, I didn't see that at all.
That's a very personal thing, though, right? I mean, if you, even where I live in, I think they're all great neighborhoods in Green Bay, but, you know, it, cars broken into and...
Yeah, you're going to have bad riffraff no matter where.
But then
go.
I think crime's up significantly because it's never happened in 10 years. You know what I mean? So yeah. I think you got to kind of weigh that a little bit. But, yeah, crime is a personal thing, but... Yeah, I think Green Bay, compared to some bigger cities, is doing much better. But, I mean, it's all, you always got to keep that as one of your top priorities.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really important.
And I want to keep the city safe. You know, I have kids and grandkids. And, you know, you always want to be safe and you want to be able to be proud of where you live and your crime rate's low.
Yeah.
That you know that's a good place to live.
Absolutely. That's, but we've done plenty of surveys on why do you move to a community and, everyone says it's because of the job. It really isn't. I mean, there's a lot of people who move because of the environment, not weather environment. And I'm talking about environment of crime, educational opportunities, quality of life issues. So let me, while we're on like neighborhoods, and I don't tie it to crime, but there's a homeless problem in Green Bay that's obvious.
Yep,
it's, obvious. And when I say obvious, not, it's obvious because it's visible.
Yep. Yep, I know you drive by St. John's Park and you see lots of people huddle up and blankets. And yeah, that's a hard solution to fix. I know NEW Shelter is building some housing for that to help alleviate that. I think we need a little bit more of that in our city. You know, we need to get partners together to build.
Yeah, and that St. John's, you let people sleep in parks overnight, and that's against the law.
Yeah.
And as I called one of our aldermen who used to be a cop, he goes, we're kind of looking the other way. I don't think that's good, because I said to him, why don't you look the other way when you gave me that speeding ticket, you know?
Yeah, they just need to come up with more places for people to go year-round, not just certain times of the year.
Yeah, I think you've heard my comments on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think what hospitals closes after 6 months?
Right.
I mean, if you're in the business, you got to take care of the people. So, yeah.
And get them on their feet and hopefully get them to be successful.
And they can be. Yep. I think people have to believe that those people can be successful, and it's going to take, but it takes the government to step in on this thing, not throw money at it, step in and coordinate things. And you're on the right track with that. We got to go to a quick break here, Jim, but I just want to talk a little bit when we get on them. Just things more about working on the city council, you know, and how it works. Cause that's a different environment.
Yeah. I kind of look at it like it's the same thing as I do in the job every day. I'm troubleshooting.
Yeah, right. All right, we're going to be right back. We're here with Jim Ritterbusch, a candidate for District 8 in the city of Green Bay. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
All right, welcome back, everyone, to Lean Local. And we're in-house guest we have with us is Jim Ritterbusch. It's kind of refreshing to talk to people who've lived here their whole life, and you lived in the same house. So I think you kind of know the city. Being a good neighbor, you know, United Way, some of those things, but being on the council is different. You're one of 12 people, and whether you're a new person or been on there 40 years, you have the same vote. And I think people need to understand that it's, you're just as, I don't use the word powerful, but just as, it means just as much no matter how long you've served or since you got on. But we had a guy on the council, you know, in one of my terms that had really good ideas, but they never got through. And I want to talk to you about how you build consensus, because you need that. You need to get five or six people to get this thing over the goal line. I mean, it can be the greatest idea. You go to the committee, and they might like it, but the council has a lot of power in the city. And tell me about relationships, building consensus, that whole area of government.
Well, I mean, once you get on council, you get to know who you're working with. You get to know kind of who's supportive of your ideas and not supportive of your ideas. And you just strategize and negotiate with one another to, you know, accomplish the goals of, you know, things for everybody, not just the select few, you know. And it's sometimes it's kind of tough because you'll have people that, you know, they don't have any faith in the ideas that you may have. And you got to talk to these people and, you know, it's kind of like negotiating. Yeah. You know, you got to give and take. You're not going to get everything.
Right.
You're not going to give everything, but you got to negotiate with one another and make it work.
And as long as you stay professional and respectful, that's the key. I mean, we had some people that would judge the idea by the person who presented it. Mm-hmm. And that's just so wrong, right? So, but I learned quickly to have somebody else present the idea if it was something I thought that they would not like about me.
So. Yeah, you work with other council members and you sign on to an idea and you say, hey, what do you think of this? Mm-hmm. You know, would you put your name to it? Absolutely. It's better for all. I'm a people person, man. I believe in helping all people, not just the select people.
So engaging with the council, you said, get to know them a little bit better and kind of build it, whatever, one, two at a time. Tell me about the engagement with the constituents. Like, how do you engage with the constituents? And, you know, I get someone who, the only time I hear from them is election time, and that's not right. I mean, you're getting paid, not a lot, but you're getting paid, and I think you have a real responsibility to communicate, not so much educate, but I looked at it as like I have newsletters and things. I thought they were educational. So tell me about your constituent relationship.
Well, ever since I've been involved in the neighborhood association, to be honest with you, I And being vice chair of Green Bay Neighborhoods, I go to all the different neighborhood associations in my jurisdiction in District 8. And I participate in them. And I'm there to, as their alderman, I'm there. And I'm also there as their vice chair of Green Bay Neighborhoods to give them ideas. I'm always out in the community. I'm doing things all the time for the different neighborhoods, from my own neighborhood to the United Way, diaper drive or blanket drive, whatever it may be. Yeah. I'm out there being seen. And I know I was kind of frustrated that my alderman, I never seen him anywhere in the city. I mean, when there's music downtown, I'm there. Yeah. When there's, you know, things going on around the parks, or, you know, you look on Facebook and you find an event, and you're like, hey, I'm going to go there.
Right.
So did you know your constituents are there? If they got questions, you're there for them.
Right.
You got to be seen. You can't just hide in your house.
Yeah, and you got to be approachable. Yep, that's really important that people come up and they, sometimes when they're yelling at me after church, I don't like, but most people were very kind, and I always wanted to be like you, very approachable. I think it's really important.
You got to be out there. You got to be transparent. You got to be seen. And like I say, unfortunately, my alderman, I used to say to him, where are you? I never see you anywhere.
Yeah, that's an important part. Tell me about the next, like, what do you want to see in economic development? Have you, I know you're on the Parks Commission, and mm-hmm. but there's the Redevelopment Authority, there's a Planning Commission, and I'm sure you attend right. some of those meetings, but like, what do you see in terms of economic development?
I'd like to see, you know, unfortunately our neighbors here are building all kinds of residential living spaces, and I would like to see our city be able to model what our neighbors are doing. I mean, it just seems like there's housing going up everywhere, apartment complexes, big ones everywhere, but unfortunately not in Green Bay as much. I mean, I know we do have some that are going in on Broadway, which took way too long to get done, but that's what I'd like to see, is more, you know, more flexibility with economic development, to get rid of some of the red tape so that developers can come in here and be successful yeah. and the city be successful on top of that.
Helps them a lot that they can call that Green Bay, though.
Yep.
I mean, because I have some friends from Sheboygan that just like, you know, I'm living in Green Bay now. I'm like, that's awesome. Where are you living? And sure enough, it's, you know.
Yeah, they're neighbors. But
they're living in the neighborhood. But all right. Hey, Jim, we got to, this one quick. Tell your listeners how they can get in touch with you. I know you're out publicly, but I'm talking about.
No, I have a Facebook page, Friends of Jim Ritterbusch. That's a way you can. I have several email addresses, but I guess I'll give you the jim.ritterbusch or greenbay.wisconsin.gov, whatever.
Okay, right.
Yeah,
I got it.
That's it's your, the city.
That's
it's on the city website.
It's the city website. Okay, or, that's the address.
Or I have ritterbusch4d8@gmail.com. Okay. That's also a way.
That's the one with a campaign one.
Yep. Otherwise, well, everything's on the website. My phone. I use my home phone number. We have an answer machine. If I'm not there, leave a message, and I return all phone calls. And some of them are kind of, what do I do with this? But if I don't know, I go to other council members and ask them, hey, how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's good. Because, I mean, you're learning, but even after 20 years, you're still learning.
Yep.
You know, it's just that's just the way good government works, and I that's great. Well, all right. This will be interesting. Just remind our voters that the election is April 7th, and of course, polls are 7 in the morning till 8 in the evening. And it's also early voting now. So you just go down to City Hall, and that's so easy. That people are so friendly down there. My wife votes early. I'm old fashioned. I got to stand in line.
I usually go early. My wife actually works the polls at City Hall.
Oh, all right, cool.
Yeah, she works. But get out and vote for me. I really want to put another, you know, 2 years into this council for sure. And, you know, build our city and keep it number one.
All right. Well, yeah, thanks for doing what you're doing. We need good government to make this city work. All right. Well, thanks for joining us here on Lean Local. We'll be back next Sunday with another episode with more older people on board.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.